We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Hey guys, what's up? Kevin Jones, founder of Blue Wire. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Do me a favor, send it to one of your friends. We're growing this network, grassroots style. It takes everyone. You're a part of our team if you send this to one of your friends. All right, enjoy this podcast and appreciate your support.
Street Shots Podcast. We're your hosts, Shamit Dua and Mason Ginsburg, and this is All Pelicans All the Time. Welcome to another episode of In the Know. We have a very special guest lined up with us. You guys may be familiar with him throughout various ESPN platforms. Perhaps you saw a recent Rachel Nichols segment on The Jump where he interviewed David Griffin. Perhaps you're familiar with his endlessly entertaining Twitter presence. We have Amin El Hassan. Amin, how are you? Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, no, we are very excited. When the Pelicans hired David Griffin and then subsequently went after Aaron Nelson, we were like, we have to go after Amin to get him as a guest, just to give us any type of perspective of what that was like with the Suns. So, I mean, I guess before we even get started, can you walk us through and give us a little bit of an intro of your time with the Suns and what you did there? And you were working under David Griffin, right?
Yeah, so Griff hired me as an intern. I interned pretty much in the video department, working with the scouts and the front office guys. And then after that, I became a video coordinator, working with the coaching staff. And working with the players and all. And from there, I kind of got bumped up to scouting coordinator and then scout. And then assistant director of basketball operations. And so that sounds like a very vague title. It's because it was purposely vague so they could make me do anything. Everything from like D-League assignments to getting our training camp handbook ready, to organizing summer leagues, working guys out, to helping with cap stuff, to analytics and video and everything. So I kind of had a catch-all kind of title. The big joke was I was the assistant director. There was no director of basketball operations. So I used to always say that my boss was a jerk who was never there, made me do all the work. So I worked for 4 years with Griff. In 2010, we went to the conference finals, and then Griff and Steve Kerr both left a day apart, probably about maybe like 2 or 3 days after our final media availability, after we lost in the conference finals. And so I worked 2 more years after that before I left and came over to ESPN. But for all 6 of those years, I worked with Aaron Nelson. Saw him all the time, and I know Nelly very well. Obviously, I know Griff very well. For those 4 years, it was a great time. You know, it was a lot of winning, and it was a lot of positive vibes of doing the right thing, and everyone's here committed to the cause.
Thank you. That's good intro. And so obviously, we've done our homework, but I know a lot of listeners are going to really appreciate that context. And that was all, I mean, a lot of new info for a lot of people. So thank you for setting the stage there. A question about a Griffin himself. I mean, we've seen, especially going from Dell Demps to Griffin, it's pretty much opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of media availability and how open and forthcoming he is with the media. We've already seen kind of a real transformation. My question is more about what Griffin's like, the Griffin we don't see. So behind the scenes, what he's like as a boss or as a leader. What are some things that would be good for fans of the team to know about him?
Oh, he's a complete tyrannical asshole. No, Griff's great. You know, Griff comes from the Jerry Colangelo school of leadership, meaning like the idea of, as a leader, it's not the 9-to-5. You don't just show up, boss people around, and go home. You know, you get to know these people, their families, you know what they like. You know, he's very much about building that kind of family environment. And that's how Jerry was. Jerry was magnanimous, but more than that, Jerry got to know you as a person. And so what that does is it does two things. I think one, from a strictly kind of transactional standpoint, it makes you a better leader because you know what makes people tick. You know what their motivations are, how to get them, how to better connect with them, right? Because you can't just treat everybody the same way. It's like, I'm going to be a taskmaster. Like some people don't respond to that, right? Some people do. But you won't know unless you know your crew, basically your employees, right? But the other part of it is, from an employee standpoint, it makes you buy in a lot more when you feel like this person cares, right, and knows. Not to play the comparison game, but when Griff and Steve left Phoenix, and Steve is very much the same way in that regard. The people came afterward weren't like that. They were just kind of blah, blah, do this, da, da, da. And so it wasn't just, the director of reports that felt it. It was everyone in the organization. It was the security guys. It was the people in marketing. It was everyone in the building felt like, oh, it's shifted, and it shifted to the back. And so they didn't get that kind of buy-in from the people who were working for them, basically. And they couldn't understand why. When I would walk through, let's say, level 0 through security and all that, that I would get such a great response. And people would come. And I said, because I know who they are. I know their name. I know their kids. And like, I know this stuff because I learned from Steve and Griff. And by default, from Jerry, like, that's how if you treat people right, they'll bend over backwards for you. If you treat them like trash, they'll do exactly what they are required by their job to do. And so I think that's the number one thing I would say about Griff is that his ability to make everyone feel valued, everyone feel valued. I was an intern, and they were asking me my opinions about stuff. When we were talking in a room, whether we were talking about draft prospect, whether we were talking about a trade or whatever, there was never a feeling of, well, what's your title? No, be quiet, right? It was, hey, you have a point to make, make the point. Obviously, make it respectfully, but you know, we're here to listen to every viewpoint on this topic, because sometimes you get a good idea, sometimes you get a bad idea, whatever. But once we're in this room, we're not going to waste time on bureaucracy and hierarchy and things like that. We're just going to come do the work. And Griff is awesome, like I said, at making people feel valued and having that kind of atmosphere. And then the other thing is, you know, for a lot of times people like to put GMs in a box, right? This GM was a former player. This GM is an analytics guy. This GM is a cap guru. This is your strength or your wheelhouse or whatever. And Griff was one of the guys that, you know, I really looked up to, because he was a renaissance man. He did it all, right? He had, you know, obviously he had started in the video room. He'd worked camps and stuff like that for, you know, back when we had the Nike Desert Classic and things like that. So he worked with players on the floor. He worked in the video room. He knew the cap. He knew the CBA. He was one of the reason he hired me was because, like, this was before analytics was a thing, before we were getting guys with, you know, master's degrees in math and applied math and stats and econometrics, right? Like, because the information wasn't so readily available, you know, all the analytics basically ran off of box score stats and lineup plus minus and stuff like that. So we were, you know, I would say fairly advanced compared to many of our peers in our acceptance of that. And that's because Griff understood its value. And that's part of why I was hired, was because of my grasp of that stuff. And so, you know, he's really kind of a well-rounded leader, and I think that gives him an advantage in the sense that he may not be an expert in any one of those areas, but when we're having a discussion about something in those areas, he's at least knowledgeable enough to know what's happening, know the discussion, and know to ask intelligent questions, as opposed to someone who's an expert at this. But then you say, what do you mean by, you know, a base year compensation? No, spare me your gibberish, lawyer man. Like, there's definitely a difference there.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible, because one of the first things he mentioned in his press conference was how he likes to build relationships with people. And I think you touched on that really nicely. And what he really emphasized was that it doesn't matter what title they are. It matters about getting the right people in. And, you know, I think you gave a great window of insight into how he operated. Now, on the other side of things, him being as well-rounded as he was, him being more of a renaissance man, did you have a look into what his decision-making process was like when it came to, let's say, I mean, it could be anything. It could be free agency. It could be draft. It could be just hiring people.
Well, I mean, so most of the decisions that it was very collaborative, right? First of all, you know, Steve Kerr for 3 of those years was the final say, basically. But Steve was in that room with us too, and those conversations were ongoing. And you know, part of this answer is going to be a little limited, because from my standpoint, my job was to bring information to the table. That was by the way, I always saw my job. I was like, look, you guys can decide anything you want. My job is to bring you all the information so you make an informed decision. So if you say, hey, I want to, I don't know. Let's say, hey, I want to pay Shucky LaDucky a full max contract, right? Like, look, you're going to do whatever you want. I just want you to know that Shucky LaDucky's knees are shot and his efficiency was terrible and he doesn't fit our style of play from these standpoints, whatever. And, like, so I'm giving you that information so that when you sign him, and then you find out, oh my God, his knees are shot. Oh my God, this guy's a terrible rebounder. Why did we sign him? Like, well, I don't want you to ever say, why didn't anyone tell me that? Right? I want you to always know everything going, hey, I know the numbers say this. I know the medical say this, but I got a good feeling. If you want to do it that way, then by all means. But my fear, my sum of all fears was for us to make a decision and decision to backfire because of some piece of information that I had, but I didn't throw out on the table. because I didn't want to be the guy who's raining on the parade. Now, under Griff and Steve Kerr, that information was always welcome. That information was always like, yes, give us that information. If it changes our mind, it changes our mind, right? Or we can choose to ignore it. Some other people are not like that. And I found out the hard way. Like, if some people think that you're just trying to rain on the parade. And so that's a very long answer to say, as far as how the final decision is made, I'm really not privy to that. But again, I know it was a collaborative effort. Like, they never basically decided things and then we'd find out about it later without having a discussion about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very fair.
Yeah, and I think the nice thing that your perspective brings on this is all most of us ever see is results and what the net final answer for some of these questions end up being. What we don't see is the process. And so hearing about that, whether it's the fact that it's more of a horizontal than a vertical organization, or whether it's collecting more information is better rather than just willingly tuning things out, it's good to hear. And I think people are going to welcome that kind of approach to management. So I want to pivot to the med staff side of this. So you said you work with Nelson your entire tenure mm-hmm. there. We'd love to get some information on just what he's like. You don't really hear a lot about these guys. It's obvious. It's always more about the basketball ops guys or the actual guys on the floor, or the coaches, the coaching staff, what have you. So it'd be great to hear just what your experience with him was like and what separates him potentially from other guys in the same role as him.
Well, I think you have to start with understanding that the training room was the single most impactful market advantage Phoenix had over everyone else. You go through the list of guys who weren't just not feeling well, but people said their careers are over. Steve Nash, Mark Cuban let him walk because he said he won't last that contract that he signed in 2004. He went on to play 9 more years, right? And won 2 MVPs in it. Grant Hill, everyone said he's just doomed to never, it was just cursed. He came back and he played, 6 more years, I believe. Antonio McDice, your knees are shot. You'll never play in this league. He went and played 4 years in Detroit and another 3 3 in Detroit and another 4 in San Antonio. Shaquille O'Neal, Miami said, it's over. He'll never play again. His career's done. He came back in a year later, his All-Star Game MVP. And so you say, what are these guys doing? And what they do is they're very whole body oriented. They're very body mechanics oriented and corrective exercises, meaning some people get hurt and they like, okay, we'll rehab and we'll do the treatment and da da da, and then boom, you're done. You're back on the court, right? What the Sun staff do is they identify all the reasons why you got hurt in the first place, because it's never just a freak accident. It's rarely a freak accident. So I'll give you a great example. I sprained my ankle during a lockout playing pickup ball. Pretty bad sprain, right? And so because during the lockout, we're not allowed to have contact with players, the training staff basically would come in and just hang out and just not do anything. So as soon as I got hurt, they were like, oh, let's, because it's work. Okay, let's do something. And so they did the whole kit and caboodle. So my ankle was probably the size of a grapefruit. And I'm like, I can't walk. I'm on crutches, whatever. They got me on the table. And Nelly was working on, basically the physical therapy, manipulation with his fingers and stuff like that, heat, ice, et cetera, et cetera. And then, within 2 days, the swelling had gone down. And I was starting to feel like the pain was going away. I felt a little weak. And so they got me on, like, the corrective exercises. And, like, after about a week, I'm like, man, I feel like I could play ball again. He's like, oh, no, you're nowhere close. And so then he gets me this whole set of corrective exercises that have nothing to do with my ankle or even my leg, my lower leg. It's like my hips and my, it's all this crazy stuff. But, like, the whole idea is, like, he took measurements and he's like, no, you sprained your ankle. You didn't sprain your ankle because you stepped wrong. you sprained your ankle because this part is compensating for this part, this muscle that's too weak, and da-da-da-da. Right, yep. And so it's all these weird little exercises, and none of them have weights, or they have weights, have very little weight. But you can, when you do it, you feel like, oh my God, it feels like I'm trying to lift a Buick. It's super hard, right? Because that muscle is so underdeveloped or whatever. And so, you know, that's a firsthand experience of a very light minor injury, really, when you think about it. But that's kind of their philosophy, is how do we get you biomechanically right so that injuries don't happen in the future? And what I loved about what we did in Phoenix is we were very serious about our training program, our athletic training and strength training program, meaning those guys had autonomy to find guys. Because players, especially young players, come, I don't want to do these weird exercises where I'm holding a towel and wiping it against the floor, like, you know, but they didn't, because many of them don't understand, like, this is going to help you tremendously in your career. Unlike, you know, an old player who obviously has been hurt and is like, man, I just don't want to be hurt anymore. Who's way more willing to accept that gospel, if you will. So, you know, Nelly was unabashed when the way he runs his athletic training program, and he doesn't pull punches and he doesn't have to ask permission. And that works because that allows the players and everyone to know, look, we're no nonsense when it comes to this. And you know, it's not like, this is not an optional thing as far as you taking care of your body, at least in the weight room and in the training room. Excuse me.
See, that type of interconnectivity is incredible. And it leads me to two questions. And I think the first one you already kind of touched on, but you know, a lot of times when fans look at injuries throughout the league, injuries on a team, many people kind of attributed it to freak accidents that, like you mentioned, it seems like Nelly doesn't employ this approach. So I wanted to ask you, like, how much do you think teams are dealing with injury problems? Does it boil down to the competency of the training staff and the methodology they use, or is it simply bad luck? And how would Nelly feel about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's a combination of factors. Obviously, there's some injuries that are bad luck. There's some injuries that are wear and tear. You can do all the right things, but you know, if it's been overtaxed and that's why you see the rise of load management, because training staffs now have all types of wearable devices that allow them to track, how players are doing and what muscle groups or what parts of them are being overtaxed and what increases the risk of injury, right? Some of it is age, right? Some of it is some guys are just predisposed to being hurt. Some people are brittle, right? And then some of it is you didn't take care of yourself. You had biomechanical failures from a imbalance standpoint, from a range of motion standpoint, from whatever, like any reasons where like you weren't basically in tip-top shape, core strength, etc. And so it varies from player and from team to team, but I think we've all read the literature about New Orleans and about how their training staff didn't do the best job. Let's just put it that way, right?
Oh, for sure.
And so, you know, when you talk about hiring someone like Aaron Nelson, you're going from bottom third in the league, bottom five in the league, and in training staffs to top five. Like that's a massive leap. And so, you know, it's not like, I said, you guys probably, you know, you reached out to me after the tweet. I said, it's not like, it's not as sexy as signing Kevin Durant, but this is like signing the Kevin Durant of trainers. You go from being one of the worst at this thing to one of the best overnight.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's interesting because it leads very well into, and one thing we wanted to get your thoughts on, moving away from the Phoenix guys that are now in New Orleans, into a more holistic view of the franchise. What's your sense on how the Pelicans franchise has been the change in perception, if it has it been minimal, has it been drastic? And I think there's two different ways to look at that. So there's obviously the media, but I think that's less important as the actual players, the coaches, the front offices around the rest of the league. What's been the change perception, if any, to the Pelicans and the way they've tried to transform the franchise over the past few months?
I'll be honest, I haven't spoken to anybody specifically as it regards to that, but I do know that Griff is one of the most respected and most highly regarded front office guys in this league. And that's players, agents, coaches, front office people. It's hard to find someone with a crossword about Griff or like a less than glowing review. So automatically when you hire him and you give him the power, that brings with it a whole lot of credibility and a whole lot of positivity. And then the other part I would point out is, you know, Griff is the only person I think in the history of the NBA to turn down at least three, if not four, front office, like general manager jobs, but four times. So I know why. They're all different scenarios, but they all came down to the same thing. Are you going to give me control? Are you going to let me do this my way? Or do you just want someone to kind of do the press releases and stay in there and da-da-da, but I want to meddle? And so I think a lot of credit goes to New Orleans ownership for giving him the conditions that he needed to work. Because, you know, again, like, this guy is very talented and he's very successful. And when you got someone like that, you give them a check with a number on it, like, look, we don't want to spend more than this, and then you get the hell out of the way. I know that they're doing that because Griff took the job. Because I know of, like I said, at least four other jobs where he went in and everyone was like, all right, here it goes, da da da. And he's like, nah. And it shocked everyone because who turns down? There's only 30 of these jobs. How can you turn one down? And by the way, general manager position, turnover isn't like coaches. Like coaches, you could turn down a coaching job because next year there's a bunch of coaches that can get fired and we do this all over again. General managers, usually 5-6 years in their tenure unless they're really, really terrible. And so, you know, you pass over a job, it may not be another open one for a couple of years. But that just to tell you everything about Griffin, kind of principled man he is. The idea is, like, if I can't do it like the way we're going to do it, and then I'm not going to compromise just to say that I got the job.
I mean, I think the fan base is going to love to hear that answer. Our argument was very similar when, in the final weeks of the coaching or the GM search, they were releasing names, and and essentially came down to Danny Ferry and David Griffin. And while, you know, we don't have a single negative thing to say about Danny Ferry, our idea was that if you go and get a guy like Griffin, think about the message it sends. And think about what it means to get a guy like Griffin, because it means you're fully empowering him and he's only going to take the job if it meets his meticulous standards. So, I think it's awesome that you shed light on that's his actual thought process.
Well, there's one more element to this that we haven't discussed, and it's Alvin Gentry. And, you know, there's one constant in this league. The best teams always have harmony and unity and same pagedness, if you want to coin a phrase, between front office and coaching staff. That's not the norm. Most teams, there's a conflict, right? Because the front office, hey, why don't you play this guy? And the coaching staff says, shut up and get out of my coach's office. And that tension exists most of the time. That's the default. That's why the best teams, you have a same pagedness. Everyone's pulling in the same direction. That doesn't mean we agree every single time on everything, but it means we can have, and Griff talked about this in his press conference, I can have an honest conversation with you without you turning around, moping, whining to your staff, whining to your agent, and like having this whole, like, you know, man, this guy's trying to screw me over thing. We can take things at face value, like, hey, I think we should play this. This isn't me trying to manipulate you into getting fired. This is me because I really think that we should play this guy, right? And so you see it in Miami, you see it in San Antonio, you see it in Golden State, you see it in Boston. And I think you're going to see that in New Orleans because Griff and Alvin have known each other a long time. and they can have those kind of frank communications. And I've seen Alvin personally, I haven't worked with him. I've seen Alvin go from having that situation and coaching his ass off and then not having that situation and becoming like every other coach in terms of being guarded, being conservative, being like really on edge. Because, you know, you think about when Alvin took over in Phoenix, Goran Dragic was a rookie who hadn't played well, hadn't played a lot. And we made it clear, look, this guy, we think he's going to be really, really good, but we got to build him up. And so Alvin told Goran on the first day, he said, look, you go out, you're going to get 15 minutes. You go out there, you play your ass off. If you play great, I might give you more minutes. If you play bad, you're still going to get your 15. If you turn around and look at me every time you turn over the ball or make a mistake, I'm pulling you out on the spot. And Alvin's message is, like, I don't want you to play scared. I want you to play with confidence and play through mistakes and learn through them and all that. And Goran's, you know, confidence blossomed after that. We had Channing Frye on our show on SiriusXM NBA the other day. And Channing was recalling about when we signed Channing, he came from Portland. He's in an early practice in camp. He's shooting. He's playing in a 3-on-3 and he, you know, catches and shoots from like 20 feet. And Alvin says, no, we don't do that here. And tells him to back up a couple of feet and shoot the three. And Channing's like, are you serious? Because at this point, I think Channing's career three-point makes was like 20 in a four-year career. He had like 20 made threes. And Alvin said, yeah, shoot. If you're open, you're a great shooter. You're open, catch and shoot, and let that thing fire, no thing twice. And Channing talked about what a relief and what a rush that was, because in Portland, they were telling him, you got to get on the block, stop shooting those jump shots, da, da, da. And here we are, we're like, no, that's what you do well. Go ahead and do it. And so Channing hit more threes, I want to say, in his first 2 weeks as a Phoenix Sun than he hit in his entire NBA career combined before that. But that comes from Alvin having the confidence to give other people confidence. And when Alvin has that, man, that dude is amazing. He's an incredible coach when he has that freedom and that, like, he doesn't have to worry about, man, if this 7-foot dude misses his first three, I'm going to hear a call from upstairs about, why is there a 7-foot guy shooting three? Da, 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 da. Like, once you eliminate that, it's almost like a limiter, right? It's almost like these handcuffs. Once you take off those handcuffs, man, Alvin's incredible.
It's exactly what Griff said. He said Alvin's at his best when he's fearless Alvin. And, like,
yes,
I didn't know fearless what that Alvin. At that time.
That's fearless Alvin. Part. That's right.
Fearless Alvin. Obviously, Griff.
Fearless Alvin pulled out a 2-3 zone in the middle of the conference finals. Man. Like, it's just like thing. We'd never practiced it the entire year. We never practiced it. We're down 2-0 against the Lakers. We never practiced the zone at all, ever. Right, he comes out and said, we're gonna run a 2-3 zone. We run a 2-3 zone, and the Lakers, because the triangle offense is designed to go up against man defense, right?
Right,
and so once you throw the zone out there, like, the Lakers are like, well, what the hell is going on? And we tied the series up, and we had a chance to win game five. And it wasn't until I think like middle of game five that the Lakers make an adjustment, and they changed the triangle, they played something different, you know. They and Phil Jackson and his thoughts about adjusting the triangle, right?
Right.
So, but that was fearless Alvin saying, to hell with it. Like, look, we're here. We might as well give it a try. And the results, you know, not what we wanted in the end, but still really good.
Was that the series where he puked into a bucket on the sideline?
Yeah, I think that was game two, I want to say. Bad asparagus, I think he wants to say. Yeah.
No, I mean, that's crazy. I think a lot of people were apprehensive about bringing Alvin back just because everyone was yearning for change. They're like, okay, if we're going to change it, let's change everything. But, you know, everything we had heard leading up to the interviews and the search was, you know, Alvin was a huge component of the interview process. And as in the ownership was asking the opinion of every candidate, you know, how do you feel about Alvin? How do you envision working with him? And obviously, it seems like Ms. Gail Benson loves Alvin as well. But it's great.
Well, I think, I was going to say that thing, one of the big things beyond, you know, obviously what I believe about Alvin as a coach and how tremendous he is and his relationship with Griff and how that works. I think even if Griff wasn't in charge, right, if they had hired someone else, think the way Alvin handled the AD trade slash didn't get traded situation really resonated with ownership and with, you know, with Mickey Loomis and those guys. Because what Dell should have been doing was getting in front of all this. Look, a guy doesn't get traded, a guy doesn't get traded. Like, it's the NBA, it takes two to make a trade happen, et cetera, right? But you can't then hide. And Alvin was forced to face the music, and he did it, and he didn't let his players kind of quit or you know, throw in the towel or whatever. They played hard, and they played reasonably competitively despite, you know, having a huge burden, like not being able to play Anthony Davis more than a certain amount of minutes or in fourth quarters or et cetera, et cetera. So I think how he handled that distressful situation really spoke volumes to ownership and management.
Yeah, those last couple months were perhaps the most like awkward pre and post game conferences I've ever seen. Like, you know, I'd show up or it'd be after the game and we'd all be in the scrum and someone always had a question about AD, and Alvin was just like, you could just tell, like, he wanted to say so much, but he's just like, I'm going to talk about the guys who played the game. And he was a total professional about it. But, you know, you've had perfect segues into our next topics throughout this whole podcast. And we wanted to get your thoughts on the looming Davis deal, or perhaps no deal. You know, now that Griff's come in, he's brought in Nelly. He's trying to bring in more people. For almost all intents and purposes, this is almost a new franchise. Can he possibly sell Davis on the idea of staying? If not, you know, how do you feel like the challenge is ahead of him in getting a good return for Davis and given like what the market is?
So, all right. So can and will are two different things.
Sure.
We have to acknowledge that, right? Glass half empty. This dude seems like he had his mind made up. He doesn't want to be here. You know, you can try, but you probably won't change his mind. Glass half full, why doesn't he want to be here? He didn't want to be here because he felt like his career wasn't going anywhere, because the organization wasn't going anywhere, which is basically an indictment on management, on the leadership and vision of the organization. And so, you know, if you have a transformation like the Pelicans have had thus far, like you got a new general manager and we change the training staff. So you've been an injury prone guy. This isn't going to be as big of an issue moving forward. And we're going to do things to upgrade the talent here and make the most out of your career. And it doesn't hurt that the guy who's in charge has a very, very good working relationship with your agent, who, if we're to believe many of the reports, was kind of instrumental in this nudge along of, okay, your time in New Orleans has run out, right? So there's reason, I guess what I'm saying is there's reason to be optimistic specifically because Griff is in charge. But I also acknowledge that players have their, you know, they have their reasons, and he might not change his mind. Like, all that can be true, that Griff can have a great relationship with Rich Paul and the organization change and it's going to be better. And Anthony Davis might still say, I want to leave. So, and by the way, that's the reason why when we interviewed Griff on the Jump, I said, what attracted you to this job? And I saw a lot of people got upset. Oh, we have a top 15 player. So I'm like, guys, no, you don't get it. Like, I'm not trying to say New Orleans is a shitty place and no one wants to be there. I'm saying you look at the challenges ahead of you on this roster. You have a player who wants out. You have a cap situation that's not ideal. Outside of Anthony Davis and Drew Holiday, you tell me who the young talent is on this roster that's making you say, ooh, this guy in a couple of years. Where's the Jason Tatum? Where's the Kyle Kuzma? Where's the Devin Booker or the Lonzo Ball or the
You don't believe in Jaleel?
Exactly, right? So by the way, he played well. I shouldn't pick on him. I think he's found a way to salvage his NBA career after a while. It looked like touch and go. But the point is, where is that transcendent, or not even transcendent, where is that young talent? Like, he could be something in this league one day. He doesn't exist on this roster, right? So, we have all our picks. Okay, that's cool, man. But like, I'm not talking about the ability. I'm talking about you have one right now. And these are the things that people look at when they're taking jobs, right? Like, do I have a chance to rapidly advance because I have the assets available? And also part of it is because I knew why Griff took the job. I was trying to tee him up on saying the whole thing that I just told you guys right now about the buy-in from Mrs. Benson and the Benson family and having the control and being able to do it the right way, et cetera, et cetera. Like, don't be foolish, guys. This is TV. I'm not actually the browbeating Griff. I'm like, why did you take this job? Mm-hmm. Again, so when you talk about the Anthony Davis thing, it's like, it could or couldn't happen. Now, if it turns out he doesn't want to stay, now you've got some ability to go out there and get a good deal. And Griff's a pretty good negotiator. And I guess one last thing about should Anthony Davis want to stay. Griff has an amazing ability to, like, pick up a rock and squeeze a drop of blood out of it. I don't know how. He just continues to do it. So if you think about when he got to the Cavs, people all think, oh, LeBron wanted to come, and then he got there. Like, no. The Cavs didn't have the cap space to sign LeBron. They took the meeting thinking, like, all right, what the hell? Griff said they took the meeting because they thought, like, a good meeting would lay the groundwork for 4 years later, like, basically LeBron now in Los Angeles. They thought that this is when they were going to sign LeBron. So they wanted to lay the groundwork right now. Like, hey, you know, like, this is what we're about, and this is what this organization is going to be about. You know, it's going to be different from what you've experienced, et cetera, et cetera. And so they come out of that meeting and they realize, oh, no, there's a strong chance that they want to do this right now. We don't have the cap space. So Griff has to go and wheel and deal and create maximum level salary for LeBron, a guy with, at the time, 10 plus years of service under his belt, so the highest max slot possible. You have to just do that out of thin air. And you got Trey Tyler Zeller and Jared Jackley, they just signed a year ago. Like, and it wasn't good contracts either, but he did it. He got it done. And when they started the year and the team wasn't good enough, he took Dion Waiters and, like, a first-round pick and turned it into Iman Shumpert and Geno Smith. And then the next year when it was, you know, lagging, he went out and got Kyle Korver and Channing Frye. And so he's got a history of being able to take nothing and turn it into something to augment this team. So even as I say, oh, the cap situation isn't ideal, Griff's the kind of guy who can take a less than desirable contract and somehow find a way to turn it into talent. Ultimately, if you're talking about keeping Anthony Davis, you're talking about I can bring in talent here to help you and continue to help you, right? Because it's not enough to go out and get, for instance, DeMarcus Cousins. Great deal. That was an excellent deal. You do it 10 times out of 10. If you have to go back, you do it again and again. Mm-hmm. But the work doesn't stop there, right? Yep. Because you've got to fill out those other roster positions. And I think that's another, like, if you look at the good teams in the league, they do a great job of that. I always say, like, the hard part is the easy part. The easy part is the hard part. Like, the easy part is, hey, who's really good? Oh, that Ja Morant kid looks good. Oh, that Zion Williams. We can all do that. Like, you don't need a PhD in basketball to figure that one out. But, like, how do you get them? Ah, that's hard because you have to go find, like, the valuable enough asset or convince someone or whatever. And then the opposite is true. It's like the easy part is regular role players are like hundreds of those dudes. You can find them in the G League. You can find them in Europe. Yeah. But the hard part about that is you actually have to do work. You actually have to watch players and scout and talk to people and do analysis and stuff like that. And so a lot of teams, I think, get stuck on, I got to hit the home run. And don't get me wrong, home runs are incredibly important. But once you hit the home run, you've got to be able to build the stuff around it. And Griff's excellent at that.
Yeah. And I think it's the one point that you made that I want to make sure we emphasize a little bit more is we talked about, it's not just about having a clean cap sheet. And I actually argue, apart from the Solomon Hill contract that's about to come off the books in a year, they're in a pretty good spot. However, the point about how the team doesn't have any young players of any importance or any, there's not one guy you look at on this roster that's, you know, that's under the age of 25 and you say, that guy, we know he's really going to be something. And that's just as big a part of it. It's not just about what the cap sheet looks like. So I think that's a really important.
And I would argue that Jrue Holiday is a really good player, but his number is high. And look, you are what the market said you're worth. He got paid that. God bless him. He was my kid. I would take every last dollar as well. But to ignore, and he's a really good player, right? Because I think a lot of times we conflate overpaid or high cap number with, oh, he sucks. He's a really good player who makes a lot of money. It presents challenges. I think we can all agree that Solomon Hill contract is bad because Solomon Hill clearly isn't as good as what he was paid during this time. He did not produce up to the level of what percentage of the cap he was occupying during the stay of his contract. But that's not the only kind of difficulties you have, right? Like when you look at Jrue Holiday's contract, it makes things harder. That's all I'm saying. And so when you have that kind of obstacle, you need someone who's creative, who can take – at the end of the day, what we're talking about is, okay, Anthony Davis is here. Jrue Holiday is here. We have this much money left for 13 other guys. How do we allocate that? And because of the size of Jrue Holiday's number, the this much money left is not as big as you would like it to be. And that's what we mean when you say – it's easy to say, oh, that guy's not going to be here next year. Okay, cool. What about the guy who is going to be here next year? Because we want him here. Like that. Those are the difficulties that we're talking about.
Yeah. So I think that leads into – so one more question regarding the – so let's say AD is getting moved. What would you look for? I know we've heard a lot of things. Like I think most people think best case scenario here is the Knicks get the number one pick and the Pelicans can pry Zion away for AD. But apart from that kind of pipe dream, What are you looking for in that potential Anthony Davis trade?
I mean, it's so hard in a vacuum to say you should get this because what you should get is only dictated by what's out there, right? What people are offering. If no one's offering anything, right? DeMarcus Cousins is on the block, and the best deal they got was Buddy Hield and a first round pick. Think about that, right? Like that's. You could say, oh, if I'm going to trade DeMarcus, I need da-da-da-da-da. But at the end of the day, hey, this is the only offer that we had or the best offer that we had if you're Sacramento. So similarly, it's nice to sit here and say, I want the sun, the moon, and the stars. But all that is relative to what's being offered. Now, having said that, Kristaps Porzingis, who has a knee issue, and is heading the free agency and all that, and came with a couple of toxic deals attached to him. They got two first round picks and a decent young player in that deal. Tobias Harris is going to be a free agent at the end of the year. Got two first round picks and two second round picks. Right. So, in some essence, you sometimes use the recent market precedents to say, look, Tobias Harris is getting four picks. You get Anthony Davis. I think we can all safely agree that he's way better than Tobias Harris. But again, it's all about what are the offers out there? Well, who's offering what? And ideally, you could say, I want picks, players, and someone takes Solomon Hill off my hands, right? But that's such a catch-all. It's a huge catch-all of so many things. Again, what kind of players? Just you want a young player who can develop into something unique, something special. But, without knowing what the offers are, it's hard to sit here and say, oh, they need to get Brandon Ingram. I don't think that's a realistic way to discuss it. I mean, it's nice from the fantasy basketball standpoint, but in reality, it's like if it's not on the table, it's not on the table. So there's nothing much you can talk about.
Oh, I've been on mute. So, yeah, no, I mean, I agree with that. It's really difficult to project out into the future what the exact ingredients of a deal need to be. Just want to wrap things up with one final question, and it's probably like a really open-ended one with no concrete answers. We saw that, Griff's gone after Trent Redden from the Clippers because he had a really close relationship with him back with the Cavs. that wasn't very successful. Not talking specific people, but do you anticipate him going after specific roles? Like, he's already brought in Aaron Nelson to be the head trainer. Are there specific areas of the front office you think he'd like to flesh out?
I think based off his conversation in the press conference, he made it seem like a lot of the people who are already there are going to keep their jobs. So I don't know if he's going to be searching for a wholesale kind of staff overhaul. I think he's just looking to tweak the staff here and there. And then going back to, you brought it up, you know, the titles are just something that you throw out there and put on a business card and stuff like that. And then the Getty captions, and there's a picture of Griff sitting next to somebody. Who's that guy? Oh, he's da-da-da-da-da. Like, but ultimately, that stuff doesn't really matter as much as getting people who are bought in and are about the right things, right? About team and about furthering the organization and about being decent human beings to one another. And I think that's the only kind of like descriptor I can put on what Griff is looking for. And obviously they've got to have some sort of basketball value to them, right? But ultimately it's about, do you fit what we're doing here?
I mean, that's holistically, I couldn't agree more with an approach. I think that's something this organization has sort of long needed to set themselves in the right direction. Now, we have Alvin here, we have Griff here, we have Nelly here. How long until he, you know, opens a checkbook for you?
I don't know. I'd rather not talk about that.
No. In any case, we really appreciate you coming on this podcast. I mean, I think this has been incredibly insightful, and we want to thank you for your time here.
Oh, no, thanks for having me, guys. And I think, again, I said it when I tweeted it a few days ago or whatever it was, you guys should feel excited. You should feel excited and optimistic in a way that I don't know you guys have felt in quite a while.
Yeah, I think it was the ping pong balls back in 2012. That's probably the last time we felt kind of like this. Maybe when AD signed his first extension. But apart from that, yeah, it's been
you probably felt excited when the Cousins trade happened, no?
Yeah, so that's much. Fair.
Yeah, like there was an excitement and a rejuvenation and a kind of a surge there.
Sweeping Portland was fun too.
Sweeping Portland, yeah, like these are, but many of these, other than probably the AD ping pong ball situation, many of these are in essence very temporary feelings. Right. Everything from this week to in the case of the Cousins trade, at least a year and see how it goes. Right. Mm-hmm. This is something that you should feel excited about. That's going to pay dividends for a while.
Honestly, beautiful. Anyways, thanks, Amin.
Appreciate it. No problem, guys.